Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. My name is Dan Dixon.
My name is Joseph Arp.
And I hesitated on my name there. Today we're talking about Burn After Reading.
Your favourite.
I think so. I look forward to rewatching Moneyball and The Big Short, I guess. But The Big Short's not better than Burn After. I don't know.
Are you talking about over
I like, there? I saw that. I like that movie.
I don't know if I like that movie.
Okay.
Christian Bale plays the drums. That's my only memory of that movie.
Christian Bale is really good in that.
He is, and not always. It's a rare good Christian Bale. He drives me crazy sometimes.
This is probably... which is funny, because I don't love this movie unconditionally. I have some problems with the Coen brothers in general. I go back and forth on them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just such a flawless film, broadly. Despite me just saying I have problems with it. I guess as a... like art object, it's a very well realized.
Yeah, it has one thing that it wants to do, which is, I think, just broadly speaking, be funny.
Yes,
and then it is just extremely funny.
Yeah,
like it feels the Coen brothers are very good at. We were talking about this yesterday. We saw it last night. We together saw the movie Judas and the Black Messiah, which we're not embargoed on.
Oh, so yeah,
we
can, it's in America.
So you can say whatever the fuck you want about Judas and the Black Messiah.
Pretty good.
Pretty good. Yeah. With Keith Stanfield, incredible.
Yeah.
Daniel Kaluuya, incredible.
Definitely.
It starts very strong, lags in the middle, and then ends pretty strong.
Yeah, I think that's right. Jesse Plemons, incredible.
Jesse Plemons, unbelievable. Who,
is he? Have we talked about him on... We've definitely talked about him on this podcast.
Yeah, because we did. I'm thinking of ending things.
Is he in any Brad Pitt films?
I don't think so.
Okay.
They could play, like, estranged brothers in a Danny DeVito, Arnold Schwarzenegger style comedy, right? Where definitely. They discover that they're, like, distantly related.
I think they actually have similar... Obviously, Jesse Plemons is, like, has kind of a rounder face than Brad Pitt.
Mm.
But there is something... in their kind of Americanness that connects them, I think.
Yeah.
They're kind of like slightly rough-skinned, I don't know, porn-pone maybe, something.
Yeah, I think I've been reading a lot of Hume at the moment because he's relevant for my PhD. In fact, he is my PhD. And Hume has this interesting section where he talks about general and specific ideas. Can there ever be such thing as a general idea? Of like, can I say, imagine a man?
Yeah.
Hume's question is, what do we think of when we imagine a man? It's like so generalized, it seems impossible to work out what that could be. Yeah, philosophy kicks ass, Dan.
I can answer that question.
That better be what you're trying to say. And Hume's argument is that we have a specific picture, but we kind of extrapolate. He says we have modes or like degrees.
Sure.
So like when I ask you to imagine infinite amounts of sand, you imagine a grain of sand and then you like turn the dial on the image of sand till it becomes like unfathomable or generalized.
Okay.
This is a digression to say, if I said to you, imagine an American man over the age of 30, you might synthesize Brad Pitt and Jesse Plemons' face and you've got like
lovely
archetypal American man.
Definitely. But I think that's right.
They feel like opposite ends of a spectrum, but like importantly linked by virtue of being on the same spectrum at all.
I couldn't have put it better.
Would Jesse Plemons have done as good as Brad Pitt in Burn After Reading? Maybe nobody would have.
He could have played the role, but it would have been a completely different role. I think this is literally a role written for Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, it's definitely, whether or not this is my favorite Brad Pitt film, it's definitely the peak of his acting prowess. I'm not saying he never matches this anywhere else. That might be the case, but he definitely isn't any better than this because it would basically be impossible.
It's the thing about the Coen brothers and about this movie that Brad Pitt is being asked to do one specific thing, and he pulls it off so flawlessly that it approaches perfection, I think. That there's like, you know, it's the idealized version of this role. Like, if you said, you know, you've got to play like a dumbass gym bro who gets in over his head but is ultimately, you know, kind-hearted... that's just the platonic ideal. This performance, like, inhabits it completely from the get-go without fail. There's no hesitation.
It's not a parody as such. It just is the thing, I think. That's why it works so exquisitely. Because it's just very... there's so many iconic lines in the performance.
Mm.
So it's so memorable. And also, I mean, he's not... disappears. Like, I mean, he gets killed, like, what, half an hour? 40 minutes before the film ends?
It feels to me, like, symmetrical, but I don't think that's actually true. I think, because his death is sooner than you would expect.
Yes.
Which is, you know, something that the Coen brothers, Alfred Hitchcock, in Psycho, like, use to their advantage. That you, you know, there's this tense scene where Pitt is hiding in a wardrobe, and you just think, there's no way he's actually going to die. And then they do it, and there's a sense of all bets are off. Who knows what the Coens are going to do?
It is, and there's kind of a musical sting there, which indicates, like, remember, this is a Coen brothers film.
Yeah.
That things can get, like, everything goes wrong for the characters, generally. In kind of, I mean, the way in which it happens in Fargo very early, mm-hmm. it kind of takes longer to pull the trigger, so to speak.
And then there's complete chaos, haywire.
Also hilariously is, like, the kind of two, if there are two archetypal Hollywood leading men, they might be Brad Pitt and George Clooney, mm-hmm. and their only scene together is Clooney shooting Pitt. within a second of him seeing him.
Yeah, and the face. I mean,
the face of Pitt, we should, yeah.
The Pitt face in that scene is iconic for a reason. Yeah. It's just this, like, shit-eating kind of hangdog. What are you gonna do?
Yeah.
And then just getting, like, instantly killed.
Obliterated.
Completely obliterated. How many movies are there in which Brad Pitt gets shot in the head? Maybe two. Assassination and Burn After Reading.
Back to back.
Which is why it's funny that they happen so close to each other.
Against a wall.
Yeah. I mean, there's a similar brutality to those murders.
Yeah. A little less all of a sudden in Jesse James, I guess, but that is very funny.
The title gives you something of a heads up in
Assassination. Not in Burn After Reading.
Be a pretty good movie title if it was like Brad Pitt gets shot in a wardrobe by George Clooney halfway through. Yeah.
He's so perfect in this film. He's so funny. Everyone is so perfect in this film. The roles were written. I'm looking for something about Brad Pitt.
In general, in your life.
You know, on the Wikipedia page for Burn After Reading, which I swear I saw earlier today, but now I can't see it. About the conversation he had with the Coens. I will try to find it about appearing in this film. But one thing I learnt from Wikipedia is that everyone was written for except Tilda Swinton.
Huh.
So they wrote for John Malkovich, Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Frances McDormand. Well, these were all written specifically for those actors. And apparently they had trouble scheduling because they just had to have them.
Yeah, of course. I mean, because each of those people are playing with archetypes that exist both on screen and off, right? The characters. I mean, there's context we can do on the Coens, and maybe we should do soon, because it's so exciting to talk about the Coens.
Yeah.
Two of my favourite American filmmakers. I'm much more unequivocal in my love of them than you are, sure. I think. But it's worth noting, of course, that Joel Coen, one of the Coen brothers, who before... So at the beginning of the Coens' career, the DGA, the Directors Guild of America, didn't allow joint director credits. Hmm. You couldn't have two listed directors because it was seen as protecting the vision of a single director. Otherwise, studios would make you hand over your power and you'd have all these. So it was really designed to protect directors and weirdly didn't protect people like the Coens who wanted to genuinely direct as a collaborative duo. They were known as the two-headed director because famously on set you could go and ask Ethan a question and then you could go and ask Joel the same question. They would give precisely the same answers, not having heard each other's answer. So Joel used to be listed as the director, Ethan as the writer, and then I think Lady Killers was their first one where it's a joint credit.
I think that might be the only... there's two Coen Brothers films I haven't seen, maybe.
Intolerable Cruelty?
No, I have seen that. Oh, wow. Raising Arizona.
Oh, Raising Arizona is incredible.
And Lady Killers. Although I've seen the original Lady Killers, which is a great film, Alec Guinness.
The Coen remake of The Lady Killers is better than people say.
Okay.
It's just like when your body of work is, in my opinion, as uniformly excellent as the Coens, there's always going to be a Lady Killers. And like a Lady Killers is better than most directors' best films.
Yeah.
So Joel is married to Frances McDormand and was married to her, knew her before he started casting her in his movies.
Oh, even Blood Simple. Because she's in Blood Simple, right?
So
their first film.
When they were very young, Joel, Frances McDormand, and Sam Raimi used to live together. So Raimi and Coen, the Coens go way back.
That's crazy.
you can see... So anyway, we can get into that in context. But I think it's interesting that McDormand always plays essentially a sweetheart for the Coens. I suppose the only rub of that is her character in Hail Caesar, who is like slightly gossipy and like a little bit...
that's true.
But it's a bit role. I think when Joel is writing a role and he's like decent, beautiful, kind-hearted woman, he's like, oh, my wife.
Although she has flaws in Burn After Reading. Sure. She's not, she's... But yeah, it is. There's a sweetness to her. I mean, Fargo is the archetypal...
Yeah, just the best person in the entire world.
There's a line, I've probably talked about this on the podcast even before, but towards the end of the film, after she's caught Peter Sarsgaard...
Peter Stormare. Very similar for in a bunch of ways. A lot of A's. Yeah.
She's driving away in the police car and she says, and it's a beautiful day.
Yeah.
And whenever I hear the phrase beautiful day, I think of that scene. Yeah. And you hear that phrase quite a lot. It's just emblazoned in my memory. It's like the ideal of optimist, kind of pragmatic, good-hearted.
Particularly because that scene that you're talking about, Stormare is silent. He's a killer who's done all these terrible things. And McDormand is saying, like, what was this all for?
Yeah.
And she's talking, I think, with a genuine inability to understand evil. She genuinely, it's never crept into her heart. She can't even fathom that you would kill all these people and behave in this way, even for money. She's just has this iron wrought set of values. I often think about one of my favorite scenes in Fargo, which was my first like beloved Coen Brothers movie. I used to watch it obsessively when I was 14, 15.
Sure.
Just in, you know, the whole thing is just printed on my memory. When she meets up with that high school friend who lies to her and says
Mike Yanagida.
Yeah, right? and claims that he dated this person and she died of cancer and that it turns out it's a total fiction. Yeah. In that scene, they meet up in a diner and Mike sits next to her in a over-familiar way. And she says, she's like, oh, it's just a bit cramped in here.
Yeah.
And redirects him to sit across from her again. And the way that she does it, it's a perfect character note of someone who does have boundaries, but is extremely respectful and kind, even when they're upholding their very strict boundaries. Yeah. It's just, it's the Coen eye for detail that is, I think, sets them apart in a lot of ways.
They're just such good writers, I think. And Burn After Reading is such a, like, they're clearly so refined at this point in just crafting, dialogue that so effectively conveys character and is also funny and compelling and engaging.
Mm.
And just not, like, no fat on it at all. No. 96-minute film, I think.
Establishes a thesis immediately in the very first scene and then just continues with that thesis in a really exciting way. We're recording upstairs in my bedroom and there's a closed window, my balcony window, and the gentle sounds of rain coming through the window.
Yeah, well, increasingly less gentle, but hopefully it creates a calming...
a calming background to talk about this film.
People pay for apps with that sound to go to sleep. Maybe exactly. You can use this podcast.
Imagine that you're listening to your daily calm with Tamara Leavitt, who is the woman who hosts the meditation app that I use. And imagine we've just kind of burst into the room.
Yeah, and start talking about Brad Pitt.
Tamara's like having a baby or something. She just had to make a rapid exit. And they were like, who's next in the phone book? And it's you and me. What I wanted to say about the Coens and their context and Raimi as well is that Raimi and the Coens are young, very smart filmmakers who I think... pivotal for the careers of both of them, their activating love of cinema is of comedies. So Raimi is famously obsessed with the Three Stooges. There's this wonderful interview with Raimi when he made Evil Dead when he's, I think, 19, like 20, something disgusting like that. And before the camera starts to roll, the interview is in full on YouTube. He's just like doing Three Stooges bits with himself, like poking himself in the eyes and going like, rawr, rawr, like these perfect mimicries of the Stooges who matter so much to him. And the Coens love early Hollywood slapstick, Preston Sturges, like very fast rat-a-tat-tat. And what's interesting, I think, about Raimi and the Coens is they always have the sensibility of comedians, even when they're making very non-comedic films.
Yeah.
Like, the Coen brothers' first film, Blood Simple, is a horror film, basically. It's just about a group of, you know, very... the urtext of the Coen brothers' work, because it's about vaguely flawed people trying to solve a problem by enlisting the help of a deeply flawed person who suddenly makes it clear to them the extent of evil in the world. You know, William H. Macy in Fargo.
Sure.
Just got some hubris. Oh, I'll sort out my problem by, it like...
turns
out. By enlisting Satan's help. Like, this is a very common pattern for them. But Blood Simple has the rhythms of comedy. It ends on a punchline. Barton Fink ends on a punchline. Yeah. Right? These are... they're very sad and not funny, but they're the setup payoff of punchlines throughout their whole career.
Yeah, they're all about rhythm.
Yeah, rhythm and pattern, I think, is the key to the Coen brothers. George Saunders has this really beautiful essay about the Donald Barthelme story. Do you remember what it's called? It's the one with the substitute teacher.
The school. Sorry. The Me and Miss...
He's written a couple of stories.
Yeah, because the school is the one where everything is dying.
That's the one that Saunders writes about.
That's probably my favourite short story.
It's this short story about a teacher, a substitute teacher who comes to a school and they have a class goldfish and then that dies and then they get some rats and then those die and then...
some children die.
Yeah, they get foreign exchange students and they die and the story ends with these children... suddenly becoming like
they ask about sex and then with him and like a teaching assistant or something and they're like, we can't do this, this is a demonstration, and they're like, what about death? They ask about death and are scared about death, and then a gerbil comes into the classroom and everyone cheers. it's online, the school by Donald Barthelme. It's like page and a half. There is no better writing.
And Saunders's appreciation of it is that he has this beautiful essay where he breaks it down and says the story begins with a problem, things keep dying, and Barthelme is excellent at like raising the stakes of the problem in like a way that becomes predictable, and then the genius of the ending is that he completely breaks the pattern.
Yeah.
He has this like established payoff, and then the gerbil returns. And the Coen brothers, I think, show a similar understanding of patterns.
Yeah.
They know how to... they know the enjoyability of rhythm that you can get... you can kind of lock into place with a film or a piece of work.
Yeah.
And then they enjoy disrupting it.
It's funny. I'm currently reading Saunders' book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, which is his analysis of Russian short stories. And he talks about this thing that Chekhov... and a lot of short story writers do, but he uses Chekhov as an example of... like, you have these two characters in a story, for instance, and you're like, oh, maybe they'll fall in love, or is this romance? And that's kind of the first readerly instinct. It's, you know, two single people who are troubled in their singledom to some extent. But you just go past that. You, like, know that the reader imagines that, and you go to the next thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of, in some ways, that's what is happening in Burn After Reading as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they play with form in a way that doesn't feel necessarily postmodern necessarily.
Yeah.
But they know that you've seen the films that they are referring to, and they're not treating them in a kind of mechanistic way. They're treating them with a kind of love.
Definitely.
It's astonishing. I mean, auteur theory gets over-discussed sometimes, I think. Films are made by a lot of people. Sure. And but there is something extraordinary about a pair of filmmakers who can make Burn After Reading and No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
And for the patterns and the similarities to be extraordinarily clear, but for the differences to be so exciting.
Mm.
You know, that they, you can see their obsessions, I think, in the broadest, maybe most boring sense of a Coen brothers' obsession. You just say it's fate, right? All of their movies have some element of... you have kicked something into gear that you can no longer control. I mean, that's Fargo, right?
Yeah.
Now that's A Serious Man.
Mm.
You know, so many of these films are about... that's Hail Caesar.
Definitely.
You know, there's all this sense of these systems are much bigger and more powerful to you.
There are people who take... like, people you aren't familiar with who take the world much more seriously than you, and you don't want to encounter them.
Yeah. I mean, I could... We were on our walk yesterday. We got ice creams. Mm. And we were walking and talking. And I was... you know, I often have this thing of saying, oh, my favorite Coen Brothers movie. But I don't know what my favorite
Coen Brothers... I really like A Serious Man.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Yeah. The ending of A Serious Man is we've discussed it in detail on this podcast, yeah. But I think it's transcendence. I think it's like artistic transcendence.
That, the cyclone, hurricane, something.
Yeah, and very similar to the gerbil walking back into the classroom at the end, so, right? Well, you establish a pattern, you have an emotion. I mean, because the scene, the penultimate scene of A Serious Man is this poor man who seems to have finally caught a break, getting a phone call from his doctor just saying,
you got to come in.
And you got to come, you know.
The tests are in.
And then tornado. Yeah. Like, unbelievable. But sometimes I think the Coen Brothers film that I find most pleasurable to just watch and rewatch is No Country for Old Men.
I've only seen most Coens once. I've seen Burn After Reading a bunch of times, but I have only seen No Country once.
I just think, I mean, there's just this, and it feeds into all of their skills, I think. There's a scene towards the end of No Country for Old Men where Anton Chigurh, the bad guy, comes to see the widow of the main character. And it's this incredibly tense scene where he's getting her to do a coin toss, which, because of the Coen brothers' use of patterns, you know, means that she's going to die if she calls the coin toss the wrong way. And it's this building tension, no music, incredible kind of shot, reverse shot of the two of them just talking. And you don't see her get murdered. All you see is a wide shot. Mm. Chigurh leaves the house, closes the door, and just checks the undersoles of his shoes for blood. And so just this... It's the detail thing, right? It's the precision that... I always say this about filmmakers I love, but they're just... The definition of genius for me is just doing the thing that 99 people out of 100 would never even consider.
Yeah.
And just making it something like checking your shoes for blood... And then the genius of No Country for Old Men is that is immediately preceded by Chigurh getting into the car accident.
That's right. Which is
also this unbelievable sequence where something new you don't expect happens. He has the talk with the kids where he, like, tries to buy the shirt off them.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
You know, just fucking hell. Ecstasy. The whole thing is ecstasy. But Burn After Reading, you think better than No Country for Old Men.
It's more fun. It's too long since I've seen No Country for Old Men. Because my problem with the Coens is their cruelty and their vision of the world, which I have, like, a strong antipathy towards. I really don't like their vision of the world, and I broadly disagree with it. And that makes it hard.
What do you mean specifically?
Well, they just think everyone is stupider than them, basically. There's very few people in their films that are smarter than they are. And that's... intelligent.
McDormand in Fargo.
Yeah, but she's still naive, right? Like, she's a cop who it takes seeing someone from her own life lie to realize. And, like, a cop who doesn't understand evil, right? Like, maybe stupider is not quite the right word. But there is something... Even with her, like, little life with Norm and the ducks on the wall and the kind of... There's something a little saccharinely quaint about that where they can have kind of a better understanding of the world than she does. They're always a little bit more elevated than their characters, and I find that difficult.
I guess I read that depiction of McDormand's character in Fargo as being about a character who has managed to keep complete moral hygiene. So it's not stupidity, it's testament to some form of, maybe we would say, emotional intelligence, that she has been submerged in evil her whole life and
has not bought into it.
And hasn't bought into it to the extent that it's
isn't a cynic.
No, and that it's still kind of unfathomable to her.
Yeah.
I also think maybe... I mean, I agree with you, broadly speaking. The difference between us, I think, is just that cruelty is basically all I'm interested in art. Cruelty and rudeness. I think I need my art to be, in some sense of the word, rude.
And I think, I think they're rude to their audiences in a way that I find... I want my art to be polite.
Have you read Maggie Nelson's The Art of Cruelty? That work of...
I've read fragments of it, but I haven't read the whole thing.
Nelson makes some arguments that I don't necessarily agree with, but she... one of her central theses is just, why do we have... She's...
Yeah.
Because we're recording in my bedroom where by my writing desk, which has a series of printed out photographs of some of my heroes, including Maggie Nelson, staring at the camera.
Or me.
Staring directly at Daniel. In fact, everyone here is staring.
Yeah.
The people are Richard Rorty, the philosopher, who looks like he's going to kill you in that photo.
Yeah, already has.
Sylvia Plath, who definitely looks like she's going to kill you. That's the most murderous Plath. And the only nice-looking, like, gentle-looking person is Louise Gluck, who is putting a hand in her hair and kind of looking at you like, well, who knows? Who knows how our future's going to pan out together? The rest have already decided that the future is death. Nelson's broad thesis is, why are we so averse to cruelty? We wouldn't necessarily, you know, if a film was all about love, we wouldn't have this immediate kind of moral response push away from it. Her argument is that cruelty is an emotional state like any other. Like, why should we have this repulsion to it? Particularly if we think that art can be a way that we can imagine scenarios that we don't have to live out.
Sure.
Do you just... You just...
That is just not... That's not persuasive to me at all. We all suffer, and sometimes we need to process that in art. But it does not seem to me... I feel like there's much more... There's just much more suffering. I don't know. I feel like this is back to... I feel like we talked about this kind of thing in the early days a lot of the Brad Pitt cast.
We did.
Haven't really recently. Well, not at the same length. But... I think I want to be... There's something inherent in cruelty in which it involves disrespect. And it involves dehumanization.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of requires you, in a way that love requires the opposite of. Love requires kind of deepening the human. And I think I want my art... I don't, like, obviously I am interested in suffering in art. Some of the greatest art has to do with suffering. But I think we need to take it very seriously and be very careful with it. Because it is very easy to slip in to... degradation, not just of, like, of both the subject and the audience. Because I think a thing that, like, I think David Foster Wallace says something about, something like this about American Psycho, where, like, it's totally fine to think that the world is shitty, but make sure your art doesn't just mimic the shittiness. And I think that's the risk with cruelty, right? And you might be able to say the same about, like, you don't want a film to be excessively sappy in its contemplation of love, right? Same kind of thing, like, you can just fall into making the narrative beats too easy. But just being cruel is not interesting to me.
I think it is to me because I don't think... I wouldn't put mere in front of the phrase mimicry. I think if you are a filmmaker who has precisely managed to capture some kind of feeling, I don't necessarily feel repugnance towards that at all. I mean, I would say that the piece of art that is... the one that I keep returning to. I'm trying to avoid saying my favorite film because I say that about too many films. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is just a precise mimicry of total cruelty and total degradation. At the one of the things that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre utilizes early on is a character in a wheelchair, so it kind of prompts this immediate kind of sense of sympathy.
Yeah.
And then that character is revealed to be awful, horrible. And you awful hate, happened to that character. You hate him.
And you don't really mind.
No, he's become so whiny and so annoying. You are so overjoyed when Leatherface takes a...
I don't know if I put it that way.
I think that's the genius of the film, is that it puts you in total cruelty. And I know that people have... I mean, it sounds like you're not making a moral argument. You're more maybe even making an aesthetic argument. You're just kind of not interested.
Yeah, both. I also have some moral problems with it. And morals and aesthetics are obviously entangled with one another.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think cruelty is very particular. I'm trying to think of my favourite films that involve suffering, and maybe like...
The Graduate is fairly suffering heavy.
Yes, but most of the cruelty in The Graduate is not sadistic on anyone's part. I'm also thinking of, like, The Seventh Seal and Stalker,
mm-hmm.
for some reason. Both because
Bergman can be unbelievably cruel.
Yeah, which is challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But there is kind of a dependence on the awesome beauty of existence that I think under... they're not nihilistic. Even Stalker isn't nihilistic, I don't think. I think... I mean, Stalker is about these people who have fantasies, right? And kind of maintain these fantasies and then ends more or less on a weird upbeat note, despite being an incredibly bleak film. And when... people are cruel. I mean, it's been a few years since I've seen it, but in my memory, when people are cruel to each other, it's kind of out of some kind of desperation or fear, and it's complicated. And I think the Coens, whose films I very much enjoy, are more or less having fun with cruelty,
which I love.
I don't see cruelty as something to have fun with. It's just really hard to convince me that is. And I get it, and I can be sometimes drawn into it. But when... I get that it's very funny when John Malkovich takes an axe to Richard Simmons in... not Richard Simmons.
Jenkins.
Richard Jenkins.
Who will work with Brad Pitt again in Killing Them Softly.
Of course. What an actor, Richard Jenkins. That's funny. But I don't like it. If I was making that movie, I wouldn't put that in.
Incredible. I mean, I'm not going to say what I'm about to say to convince you... when we have these discussions, with which I have quite a lot in my life, I'm always thrust inwards in a slightly desperate, panicked way because... So I have, over the last 7-8 months, become completely obsessed with a video game called Dead by Daylight.
Yeah.
In which you play various serial killers from slasher franchises. You can play as the cannibal from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Leatherface. And the point of the game is killing teenagers and then hooking them on these, like, meat hooks as sacrifices.
I mean, games can always eventually just become chess, right? Like, they can always... everything can always stand in for something.
Dead by Daylight is just chess. But I like it more than chess.
Yeah.
And the reason I like it more than chess is because I enjoy luxuriating in cruelty, and I particularly love... a sense of fun with cruelty. Someone once watched me play the game Dead by Daylight, where... this won't turn into a Dead by Daylight podcast. Sure. One of the tactics in that game... there are four human survivors. You're one killer. They have to spend 30 seconds per generator fixing these electronic generators which power the exit gates so they could leave.
Sure.
So it's basically tag. You have to go over, you have to hit them twice.
Yeah.
And then you put them on hooks.
Yeah.
As you put someone in tag. And
you can totally imagine primary school children playing a game with this rules that didn't involve the viscera.
And so an advantage, because if you kill one person, the other three can still fix the generators.
Mm.
So in DVD terminology, they call it slugging, which means you can hit a human character twice, they're on the ground, and then leave them on the ground. They can't pick themselves up, but they can be picked up by other people. And this is all to say, I was playing this game in front of somebody who watched me slug four human beings, which meant that I went around and I think I was playing as Leatherface, which means I was just like chopping teenagers up, watching them bloodied on the floor, crawling towards me, and then pick them up and hang them on a hook. And this person turned to me and said, watched in total silence, and then turned to me and said, are you a sociopath?
Yeah. Does this person play video games?
No.
Sure.
There aren't many video games that operate on that level of sadism.
No.
Where there are these helpless people who you make a decision to do something terrible to. And moreover, usually video games treat suffering in some kind of narrative way.
That's true.
Like The Last of Us Part 2 is a game that's end-to-end suffering. I couldn't finish it. But the suffering is meant to make you...
it's not,
you're meant to be repulsed by it. Whereas Dead by Daylight, there's no ultimate function.
To be honest, in video games, I think I kind of prefer the Dead by Daylight model than the Last of Us 2 model.
Yeah, you just don't like the pontification.
Yeah, I don't want to learn a lesson, certainly. I know suffering is bad.
Yeah, but why don't you have that response to art?
One of my radical takes is, well, I don't care. Like, are video games art? bullshit conversation, because the thing that people always forget when they're having that conversation is, like, most art sucks. Like, most art is very bad, and I think there are very few video games that are, like, even worthy of consideration as art.
Really? Yeah,
absolutely. Because they depend so much on functionality. They depend so much on building themselves around, like, a set of rules that I just think there's not much room for artistic expression. I know that's controversial, among some circles.
I think it's controversial for me. I don't think video games can be art when they try and be movies. And my least favourite video games...
Well, no, but they can be, but they're just bad, right? Like, of course they can be art. Like, there's no... I don't think art... The criteria for something being art, to me, has nothing to do with quality, because I have been to some really shitty grad show art, like, painting exhibitions, yeah. And that's... of course, it's art, fine, but it's just not good.
I suppose it depends on whether we use art as just a stand-in for desirable, creative outputs, or if we just say it's a certain mode of telling stories.
I think it's a mode of expression.
Yeah. I think video games are at their worst when they just want to be movies.
Definitely.
And you're just running from cutscene to cutscene.
Yeah.
And I could imagine a very good movie divided up into a video game format.
Yeah.
But that's not what I go to ask. Husband's the video game. Incredible. How would you get to London in that game?
You have to just, like, aggravate as many people as possible in New York.
You get, like, aggravation points. Yeah. And you could GTA 5 style, you can swap from character to character.
Definitely.
But they're functionally precisely the same.
They're indistinguishable, in fact. You can't really tell who you're playing.
They're all just puking and smoking and getting angry. What would John Cassavetes think of GTA 5? These are the important questions.
Can't even fathom it. I don't know. I think cruelty is kind of easy. We're all familiar with it. I mean, the funny thing is, I think... yeah.
Go on.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of... I think cinema has a unique problem with cruelty because it's so easy to convey in visually. Like, I think literature is much harder to... And it's much harder to do it uncomplicatedly in literature, I think, and if the literature has, like, artistic aspirations. But I think with cinema, you can just, like, show something horrible happening to someone very quickly.
Yeah.
And you can do it within a vocabulary that seems artistically merited, but it feels easy and not very interesting to me often. I don't know if the comments fall into that trap, actually. I think their cruelty is quite complicated.
I think it...
And interesting. And, like, gets me in. Like, I've seen... They would be among the directors, probably, like, of whom I've seen the highest percentage of their cinematography. Filmography, rather.
And it's interesting what the Coens don't do with their cruelty is what some people do. We mentioned Saunders before, and I find Saunders actually...
Oh, yeah. Saunders is rough.
But I find him deeply, deeply optimistic and positive, because what he shows you is the structure of any George Saunders short story, less so Lincoln in the Bardo, his novel, more the short stories, just here is a person going through unbelievable cruelty and terror, and here's how they remain resilient, or here's how they continue to treat people well. And the only... Coen Brothers movie that's like that is Fargo, I think, where cruelty is being utilized as a equal and opposite reaction to goodness, because there's no essential force of good in Burn After Reading. The essential force is chaos.
Yeah,
it's a movie about entropy, the way that the universe prefers disorder, because it just everything falls apart at every single possible point.
Yeah.
Who's the best? Who's the kindest character? Maybe Jenkins.
Yeah.
Because he's
acting on kind of loving impulses, you might say.
And he gets an axe to the neck.
Yeah. Which is not, like, is sometimes how the world works. I don't want the world to work that way. And if you're portraying the world as working that way, I don't want it to be nihilistic. I don't want it to be like, well, fuck, you know, I guess this is what happens.
Which is literally the ending of Burn After Reading.
The thesis of this film. But at the same time, it's a magnificent film.
Hmm. How do you hold those things in your head at the same time? I don't think it's possible for me to do that. I'm not saying you're deficient. I think sometimes I'm deficient. I have to be totalizing in my views of films.
I'm not totalizing my view of anything. I think I...
That's why we do a podcast together.
Yeah. I have a voice in my head that is like, this isn't okay. This is not compatible with my experience and desires and beliefs. But I'm having a good time. And I think that is sometimes, like, I think you're having a good time is like, that's the end of the story.
100%.
Which I respect.
100%.
And I think it's, like, I do a lot more interrogation, which might be less authentic in some ways. I think they both have their, like, chinks, you know? Like, yeah. there's issues with those. I mean, no one's worldview is entirely consistent either. But I watch Burn After Reading, I have a really good time. But even when I'm having a really good time, I'm like, I don't feel... Like, the kind of conversation within me is like, this is a funny character, this is wonderfully executed. But I'm like, oh, George Clooney's a little bit too much, a little bit too mean. John Malkovich's character is perfect.
Yeah, it's genuinely perfect.
The second John Malkovich film with Brad Pitt, I think.
What's the first
one? Being John Malkovich.
Oh, of course. Of course, we covered it. I was going to offer up Malkovich as an example of... a flip side to the Coen's obsession with stupidity.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. And that is, might be one of the things that makes me really like this film.
He's too smart.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, there's an alternate reading on the Malkovich character where he's an idiot who thinks he's smart.
I mean, in that reading, everyone's an idiot, which I kind of appreciate, apart from the fact that the Coens never seem like idiots.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not quite sure what that looks like, but I would like a film that is a little more humble.
Hmm.
John Malkovich ends this film with Richard Jenkins yelling, like, who has gone into his apartment. We haven't talked about the plot of this film at all. You should really watch Burn After Reading.
We're just going to start saying that now. I mean, the plot is...
It doesn't really matter.
We could do it in two sentences, let alone four sentences. Do you want to try it?
You try it.
Disgraced member of the...
CIA.
The CIA. I was going to say CIA.
How about we do one sentence each? You do the first sentence.
Incredible. Yeah. I could really fuck you.
I know. Yeah.
I could be like Brad Pitt's in this movie. A disgraced member of the CIA leaves the organization and writes what he believes to be an explosive memoir about his time there.
Yeah.
And the memoir falls into the hands of a pair of blundering buffoons who try and sell it to the Russians.
Yeah. The blundering buffoons set up a series of misunderstandings by trying to bribe John Malkovich and selling it to the Russians, which results in the death of the blundering buffoons of Francis McDormand and Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's death and McDormand accidentally sending Richard Jenkins to his death because... I mean, that's it, right? That's all that matters.
And she gets what she wants.
Yeah.
Which is plastic surgery. So that is maybe the cruelest note in the film, right? That, you know, what did it all come down to? A woman achieving her dreams. Oh, what were her dreams? Plastic surgery.
It's also very funny. So the Richard Jenkins, Francis McDormand, Brad Pitt all work at a gym called Hard Bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are particularly... I mean, Brad Pitt is fit, obviously, because he's Brad Pitt, but...
It's great that Jenkins works at the gym. It's
incredible. There's this wonderful scene. Like, this is the Coen's attention to detail. He obviously is in love with... What's McDormand's... Linda Litsky or something? It's a great name. That. And he's like, I wasn't always a manager at Hard Bodies. A series of just exquisite line readings. And he takes a photo out of his wallet of him as a Greek Orthodox priest.
Yeah.
He's like, wow, that's a great job. You know, what happened? It's like, it's a long story. It kind of stares into the distance. Perfect.
Yeah.
That's perfect cinema.
Yeah.
That's why it's so hard to, like, it's so easy for me to love this film still. Scenes like that, I mean, it doesn't get better.
They know precisely how much is bare minimum.
Yeah.
That's a Coen skill throughout.
Hail Caesar's pretty good at that as well. A lot of, like, little nods and...
Yeah, they know that they don't need to overstay their welcome.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before. The Coen brothers are not good at talking about their own art. They give interviews and they just don't say anything. But I remember when No Country for Old Men came out, which was just such a fucking exciting year for me.
You know, they made, like, I was looking at their filmography. They're, like, 4 years where they came out with movies.
Yeah.
It's really crazy. There's, like...
Hit me with them.
Let's see.
Because Hail Caesar was after quite a break, yeah, wasn't it?
This is 2007.
Mm-hmm.
No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
2008, Burn After Reading. 2009, A Serious Man. 2010, True Grit.
Unbelievable. That's crazy. I mean, we haven't even talked about True Grit, which I think is an extraordinary wonderful film. Western. Truly extraordinary.
That's 4 years. Directors.
Yeah.
Just, that is crazy.
Yeah, what a run. An unbelievable, unmatched run. And then they break for a while before Hail Caesar, is that correct?
Yeah, so Inside Llewyn Davis and then Hail Caesar. Inside Llewyn Davis is 2013.
I don't love Inside Llewyn
Davis. I saw it once at the cinema when it came out. I liked it. I tell you what I've watched a lot is the video of Adam Driver, Justin Timberlake, and Llewyn Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's his
name? Oscar Isaac.
Oscar Isaac singing Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Yeah, incredible. Just
look that up on YouTube and... Yeah.
Have your day made. No Country for Old Men came out. I'm sure I've said this story before, but it's, you know, sometimes something in your life can be so good once that you can spend the rest of your life chasing that high.
Sure.
And for me, that was the 2008, I guess, Academy Awards, which were dominated by a matchup between No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood. Two films that I just think are as good as American movies get.
I think that was an important year for me as well. Obviously not to the extent, but that was like probably a year where I like realized contemporary cinema could be pretty interesting.
Yeah, true. I mean, and famously, there's a sequence in There Will Be Blood, one of the extraordinary films of the 21st century cinema, maybe art in general, where there's a burning oil field that needs to get blown up. And the smoke created by that sequence being filmed meant that the Coen brothers had to take a couple of days off from shooting No Country for Old Men because they were shooting in the same area and it was like fucking up the sky.
Funny.
They needed plain skies and instead Paul Thomas Anderson's over there.
That's amazing.
Chain smoking and like standing behind the camera watching the oil get lit on fire. Coen brothers gave an interview with David and Margaret, who for non-Australians were, for a period, our upper echelon of film criticism, even though, fuck David and Margaret.
Okay.
Margaret slightly better, but they were fuddy-duddies who made extremely irritating, moralizing arguments about violent art that was a real problem, I think.
Hmm.
It meant that they ignored Wolf Creek and Wolf Creek 2, which are works of art that examine Australia's troubled genocidal history with more intelligence than most other films made. But they just, they didn't even review Wolf Creek 2 because they walked out. So, you know, fucking... When you live in a culture that has two cultural arbiters, David and Margaret, you need them to fucking be pretty good, because otherwise you're going to have a real dearth at the centre of your country's ability to self-reflect.
Maybe one day it'll be us on the ABC.
Hey, can you imagine? David and Margaret interviewed the Coen brothers.
Mm.
This is a very long-winded way to say. They said in this interview, we spend a lot of time on our scripts trying to decide how much we need to show the audience. And they were referring to the sequence in No Country for Old Men where Josh Brolin's character has bought the tent poles and is hiding the money above the in the vent in between the two rooms by pushing it with a pole, and someone keeps walking back and forward between the floorboards so he can see them through the door. And the Coen brothers apparently spent days trying to work out how many times should he check underneath the door to see. And they want to shave it down till it's, like, just enough to give you a mammoth impact.
I will say, this probably wasn't your intention, but that is... It's true about them. And probably the best argument against my argument that they don't necessarily respect their audiences. Because they do require... It's, like, in Burn After Reading, did I miss it? Or do you just never see John Malkovich leave the CD at Hardbodies?
No, I don't think you do.
Don't, right? Like, which is really interesting. Like, yeah. Any other director would have a scene of him going in and... Or maybe it's... Is it... I can't work out... Actually, I don't think it's him. I think it's Tilda Swinton.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But I don't think you see much of that. No. If any.
No.
And... It, yeah, they're very... It's like, again, this is... this. You can totally imagine this being a 2.5 hour film.
Mm.
And being bad... Being much worse for it.
Yeah.
And there's so much that they shave off. You don't see Richard Jenkins going to John Malkovich's house at the end. He's just there.
Yeah.
It's really tight.
The understanding of what is essential.
You barely... Like, you know that John Malkovich has a problem with alcohol, but you don't really see him drinking that much.
No.
There's that extraordinary scene, a all-timer, where he's doing athletics in front of the television in his boat that I just thought of. The scene with his father, where he, like, is telling his father, I'm going to write my memoirs. I think you'd approve. And the father is... kind of doesn't have great cognitive function, and he's just sitting on the boat, very old, and Malcolm, like, early on.
Yeah. They can balance... I mean, it reminds me of the magic trick, weirdly. Maybe this is, again, a comparison not often made. It reminds me of the magic trick of the first Lord of the Rings film.
Mm.
That leanness, that tightness, that ability to drive forward plot, establish character... have something kind of going on aesthetically or formally.
Yeah.
Like, to do them all at the same time. I mean, we don't... People won't have seen Judas and the Black Messiah when this episode comes out, so we shouldn't talk about it too much. But my problem with that film was... it's very well acted. It tells the story of the murder of Fred Hampton very well, if you don't know that story. But there's just not enough humanizing moments, and there's not enough formally disruptive moments.
Yeah, there's a couple really good ones.
Yeah, the beginning is... It starts at a fucking fever pitch.
And the end is very good.
Yeah, I was blown away by the opening. Yeah, I was like, too. Oh my god, I'm going to see something unbelievable.
Yeah, and there's a few... Anyway, it's worth seeing.
Yeah, it's definitely
worth seeing. But I agree with your broad argument about that film.
And... the thing you think when you're watching that film, and I think when you're watching lots of films, because lots of films are deeply flawed, it's very hard to make a not flawed film.
Yeah.
You can feel Judas and the Black Messiah shifting gears. Yeah. You can feel it being like this is the plot, here's the character, here's the... And what the Coen brothers can do is juggle things in a way that seems... You can barely
identify the act breaks.
Yeah. Yeah. In a way that seems like a sleight of hand magic trick. Yeah. Your attention is being... so demanded by the humor that you don't, you know, you're not even paying attention to the construction until you're in the middle of it, and it looks extraordinary.
Can we talk a bit more about Brad Pitt in this film?
Of course we can.
I've talked to you about this already off mic. When there's a moment where Frances McDormand is like looking up, the real introduction to his character is she wants to do online dating. She's like looking at some guys, and he is like behind her. And I think she talks about one of the occupations of one of the guys she's looking at going on a date with, and he says, oh, that's cool.
Oh, that's cool.
And there's the phone conversation when he's threatening John Malkovich with, like, we've got, like, the
security, you might want to know about the security
of your shit. When he is in the car with John Malkovich and he says, you think that's a Schwinn?
Yeah.
And Malkovich punches him. He, like, Malkovich is, like, being dismissive of his bike, which he has ridden to meet him.
Yeah.
And then he says, you think that's a... And he calls it a Schwinn. Yeah. And Pitt laughs and is like, in a very serious moment, just kind of breaks and, like, giggles.
Yeah.
And then gets punched in the nose. And, oh, there's this wonderful little moment where... Then after he gets punched, he gets out of the car with Malkovich, and then McDormand, like, pulls up, and she's like, did you get the money? And you can see him, like, he's not immediately like, no, of course not. He just, like, he, like, realizes he didn't get the money. He's like, oh, because they're trying to bribe him, and Malkovich is like, no, you're committing a felony. You're blackmailing me. This is, you know, you don't know what you're in for. And he's like, oh, no, he punched me. This kind of, shift in attitude or demeanor that he has is just so beautiful. There's so many... He just gives such a perfect performance in this film, better than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, better than
do you think... I think it's maybe so this good. Is a thing we do when we wrap up, but for me the top tier of the Pitt performances are Assassination of Jesse James, sure, Burn After good. Reading,
yeah,
Killing Them Softly,
yeah,
Moneyball,
yeah,
and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, I think that's... I've seen all those films now,
and I think the strength of those five performances is not only that Pitt is an extraordinarily talented technical actor, which he is, it's the way he is used, the elements of his star persona for each of those is, like, selected.
Yeah.
Billy, whatever his name is in Moneyball, has...
Bean?
Billy Bean, yeah.
He inhabits that character.
It's just unbelievable. Sometimes I think maybe that's my favourite Pitt performance.
I also think it's pretty hard to not sound... Like, I actually quite enjoy a bunch of Aaron Sorkin stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, hit and miss. But I think it's pretty hard to sound like an actual human being for when you're reading Aaron Sorkin dialogue. And yeah. he really manages it.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone else in that film really does.
No.
Like, if you think of the iconic Aaron Sorkin performances, they're kind of all, like... plastic superhuman-y robot types, like Jesse Eisenberg. Is the archetype. Even in, like, there was that great line that A.O. Scott had about the trial of the Chicago 7, where he said it's, like, a very special, sober episode of drunk history. And that is kind of, like, these people are kind of performing as historical characters, right? But Pitt in Moneyball,
yeah,
exactly. It's very humanized.
Yeah.
It's really crazy.
Yeah. And in that, I think in Moneyball...
It's just dad, you know?
Yeah. In Moneyball, what is selected to be utilized is his decency. In Assassination of Jesse James, it's his sadness.
Yeah.
In Killing Them Softly, it's his anger and his sense of regret. In Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's his kind of chill nature.
Yeah.
And in this, it's his stupidity. He is...
I'm sure you could do a, like... Lawful Good, except for D&D thing with those Brad
Pitts. You really could. Who's true neutral? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, maybe. Definitely. And Lawful Evil. Or is Jesse... Is Jesse James chaotic evil or lawful evil? Chaotic neutral?
Maybe chaotic neutral.
Yeah, I think chaotic neutral.
The Killing Them Softly character is actually, I think, probably lawful. Like, that's deeply rule-bound. Maybe lawful evil. Although, I think he's kind of... We get to talk about Killing Them Softly and Moneyball.
That is exciting.
On this podcast.
Billy Bean is lawful good, right?
Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. The Burn After Reading character... One of the beautiful things about it is a polishing of the character he played in Cutting Class. You know, this is the older brother of the character in Cutting Class.
The coach of, right?
Yeah, you can imagine the two of them together being kind of doofuses, you know, thinking that they're, the Cutting Class character looking up to the fucking Burn After Reading character. That guy handled that really well.
Dumb jocks. But not... Yeah, with some beautiful degree of humanization, I think.
I think we just end up... not to invoke him again, because we can't be a Brad Pitt podcast that often invokes Ludwig Wittgenstein. But Wittgenstein has this concept of primitive ideas. Actually, I thought it was a Wittgensteinian thing, and then because I'm reading all this Hume... Hume does it too. Hume's... calls them simple ideas and says that there are these ideas that cannot be further subdivided, by which we mean there's nothing more you can say them. And
Wittgenstein says, I turn my spade and, you know, at some point my justifications are exhausted, I turn my spade and I'm done, basically.
Yeah, I just can't tell you anymore. We hit some kind of bedrock. Humanity is the kind of thing... Humanity in an actor is the kind of thing about which I can't really say anything. I just have to point.
Yeah.
It's a primitive or a simple concept for me. And Pitt has it here.
Yeah.
He plays a caricature. There's nothing about anything that the character does that feels human.
Sure.
Because the character is actually so outsized, they don't really resemble any person you've ever met.
Yeah.
But there is just some... There is a...
Yeah.
You have to talk in cliches when you're talking about... There is just a beating heart. We actually said the same thing last night about the Jesse Plemons character in Judas and the Black Messiah.
Extraordinarily human.
Yeah. Despite subtle. Playing a racist with basically no redeeming qualities. Yeah.
And not a racist cliche. Like, definitely racist and bad. But, like, complicated in really interesting ways.
Yeah. Deeply interesting ways.
just while I think about it, also, I want to give a shout out to Will, who sent a very lovely email about looking forward to the burn after reading, so I hope.
Because Will said real ones know.
Yeah, which I think is, I accept that.
I like this film a great deal too.
It's, yeah. I really do. If there's a five-star film, it's a five-star film.
Really?
Even given my misgivings about the Coen brothers.
How fascinating. Yeah.
Watching it again, I was really impressed.
Yeah, what is this from? Someone says it as a joke. Tight as a drum. Yeah. But it is tight as a drum,
which I really respect. Clooney is very funny.
Yeah, and the revelation that you think Clooney is, you know, what's he building in his basement?
Yeah,
and it being a sex swing is so funny. Yeah.
That reveal.
Yeah, just sending it swinging.
Yeah.
I think I really only like Clooney when he's in the hands of the Coen brothers.
Sure, I think that's fair. An idiot.
A true idiot. Yeah. What else is... Oh, Intolerable Cruelty.
And also...
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Incredible film. Sensitive and humane. Maybe they're like kind-hearted, most kind-hearted film. Even though there's a scene in which John Goodman squishes a toad in his bare hands and then hits people with a big old bit of stick.
I mean, born for that role.
Yeah, absolutely. What was I watching Goodman in the other day and just thinking, we don't appreciate John Goodman in the way because he's slipped into this role of like caricature, we don't often enough just talk about the fact that John Goodman is... A truly dynamic performer who always is fun to watch. Have you seen the Cloverfield sequel where he's got those people trapped in the fucking basement?
No.
Incredible. Like, genuinely incredible. Although, have I been on this tirade about Cloverfield before?
I've only seen the first one. Somehow.
J.J. Abrams made the first Cloverfield film and then decided that his plan for the future series was to take... scripts that were blacklist scripts that couldn't get made.
Oh, and turn them into
Cloverfield. Very funny movies. So the Cloverfield sequel, which is called 16 Cloverfield Lane, started out as a spec script. And the script is, this woman wakes up, she's being held hostage in a basement, and a man, played by John Goodman, says, you can't go outside because there's been an alien invasion and the world outside is inhospitable.
A South Park plotline where Cartman puts butters down the well because he wants to go to Casa Bonita, I think.
But the genius of the spec script being its own standalone property is that the central tension is John Goodman telling the truth?
But it's Cloverfield movie. And by
virtue of the fact that it's a Cloverfield movie, you know he is!
Yeah.
It's insane. It's like, I understand maybe it's just what you have to do to get the film made, but it's crazy.
It's like a Godzilla sequel, that is.
Yeah. Well, is Godzilla real? Yeah. You're just sitting there like, yes!
Yeah.
It would maybe have been smarter, and there's maybe a reason why they didn't do this, if they called it a different name and you discovered in the last 10 minutes that it was a Cloverfield sequel.
I bet J.O.J. was considered that because he loves huge twists.
Yeah.
But the studio was probably like, no.
Did you see his 5 minute segment on the Cloverfield movies? You've only seen the first one.
Yeah.
The third one, the Cloverfield Paradox.
Which is the Netflix one?
Is that one.
In space?
Yes. So I'm going to spoil the Cloverfield Paradox for you, but consider this a great virtue that I'm doing to you because it might be one of the worst films ever made.
Yeah.
It's about these people in space who like suffer some kind of cosmic shift where they've like, everyone's warped slightly to the side, so someone gets like embedded in metal. It's very silly.
Okay.
It's far less interesting than it thinks it is. Elizabeth Debicki, our queen, is the villain. Everyone kind of goes crazy in space. It's a 92-minute movie of people going crazy in space.
That sounds good.
It just doesn't work, sadly. And then the film ends with the character getting into an escape pod. Film is finished. Elizabeth Debicki has been killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the problems are resolved. Gets in an escape pod to come back down to Earth. Is shooting down to Earth. And the film suddenly, so clearly, I've never before seen the consciousness of a film so clearly snap into action. The movie just goes, fuck, we're a Cloverfield sequel. So the final shot of the film is no joke. The escape pod hitting through the clouds of Earth, then, you know, the clouds, like, disperse slightly,
And then a big old Cloverfield monster, like, sticks its head through the clouds, screams, and that's the end of the movie.
Is that the first appearance of any Cloverfield content? That's insane.
So the film just suddenly goes like, fuck! what the hell? What did we do?
That's very funny.
And again, maybe that works if you discover in the final shot that it's a Cloverfield sequel, but otherwise you're just sitting for 90 minutes going like, where the fuck's the Cloverfield? And it's in the last shot. I highly recommend looking it up.
Because it's on Netflix, right? I remember the Super Bowl, it was like announced. Everyone was like, wow, a movie that's dropped immediately. I'll go check it out. And they're like, this is garbage.
Can I maybe show you with the sound off the final shot and we can have a live reaction?
The Brad Pitt cast reacts to the final shot if anyone wants to put this on YouTube.
Open up my Windows Explorer and the first thing is my abstract for the Conference of Death that I'm submitting a paper to.
I'm going to use this opportunity to try and find that thing about
the Cloverfield Paradox.
Holy, a very funny name.
A deeply funny name.
If there weren't already Cloverfield films, it would sound like a Seinfeld movie.
It really would. So I'll just jump quickly through to show you. Do you have your Brad? Do you want to do Brad Pitt first?
Pitt, who plays a particularly unintelligent character, said of his role, "After reading the part, which they said was handwritten for myself, I was not sure if I should be flattered or insulted." Pitt also said, when he was shown the script, he told the Coens he did not know how to play the part because the character was such an idiot. There was a pause, and then Joe goes, "You'll be fine."
I love that.
Okay. Government, this is...
Cloverfield Paradox. So I'm just going to skip through and show you a little bit. So this is... It's like...
space.
Alien, like Solaris style.
Boring spaceship. Some...
Elizabeth Debicki giving people a hug.
Yeah, people are hugging again. Oh, yeah.
The problems are happening. Everyone's standing around. International crew. So they have differences. The comedian from the IT crowd is here some reason.
Oh, he is too, isn't he? Some girls.
People start going crazy around this point. You can tell because there's more flashing lights.
Sure.
The ring spinning off its axis 17 degrees.
No Cloverfield so far.
No.
Okay. Things seem to be going wrong in space. Everything is blue.
Yeah. Because everyone's got to remake Alien.
Okay, someone's in space.
So the main character has managed to defeat all the obstacles. She's gotten into a escape pod. Mm-hmm. Here she is. Her family at home saying,
"Oh, maybe there's something wrong by going back. It seems like the capsule's descending."
Tell them not to come back.
It's too late. The capsule is soaring and plummeting through the various tiers of the atmosphere. Oh, and there's a Cloverfield monster. Oh, wow. Loud roaring. Is it going to eat the capsule? That's it. That's the film. That's crazy.
It's so funny. It's like you took...
that is bonkers.
It's like you took the script for, I don't know, like a gangster drama, and it ends with the gangsters getting away in a car and driving home, and then someone's like, tell him not to come here. Tell him not to come
Kong
here.
Kong is here.
Yes. Or Borat is here.
Yeah, you know? Sure. Like
a spelled Borat sequel. Tell them
Jason
not to...
Jason Bourne.
Shit. Yeah, imagine, and that's why
the Jeremy Renner one.
Imagine if you were like, oh shit, there's a new James Bond movie, and then the film is, you know, a couple making their way through Europe, and they drive past James Bond, he's like sitting on the side of the road hitchhiking, just cut to black. Incredible.
Good stuff.
The modern streaming.
None of you have to watch the film now.
No, you really... I can't stress how much you don't need to watch The Cloverfield Paradox. Anyway. The fact that it wasn't just announced during Super Bowl and then immediately dropped. It was forward teased by, on Twitter, the filmmaker Ava DuVernay, who tweeted and said, "Something unbelievable
game changing for the industry is about to happen.
Yeah, that's right. And then it's real less than expectation setting.
Particularly because why did it premiere on Netflix? Because the studio that made it sold it.
Yeah,
because it was
that. And why was it dropped with no yeah. forward advertising marketing?
Yeah, exactly.
Bad film.
Because it turns out it sucks.
Yeah.
Imagine. I mean, and it's designed right to keep you interested in the entertainment machine. Because imagine if you could just, if it was like, new Coen Brothers film, dropping on Netflix, dropping on Stan in 12 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be filled up for days.
Speaking of that, Buster Scruggs, I could not finish. I forgot about that because it was too cruel. The Liam Neeson storyline, that was intolerable for me.
I love that.
Shouldn't
one.
Exist. That was real, like, I'm done with this. I could not finish that movie.
Does that mean you didn't watch The Gal Who Got Rattled, which is the second to last storyline?
I must, yeah.
You must have not seen it.
Yeah.
That's even crueler.
Okay.
That's, spoiler alert for Buster Scruggs. The plot of that film is that it's a woman making her way across country as kind of part of an Appalachian Trail style kind of series of wagons with her husband. And her husband dies during the trip, and it's quite dangerous. They keep getting besieged by, you know, hostiles.
Mm.
And so this man gives her a gun and says, listen, you know, the way they treat women means that if you see them coming and you're unprotected, just shoot yourself in the head. And the storyline ends with her stranded in a field by herself. She sees what she thinks are hostiles approaching, shoots herself in the head, and it's the people come to save her.
Yeah.
So, and that's it. There's no... Buster Scruggs is their most gnomic film, I think.
Yeah.
In that it's just very hard, really, to tell what it's about, and it seems to deliberately evade meaning.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for someone to write about that film... And I don't always have this approach to art, but, like, I could imagine a piece that really, really sensibly explains it, because it feels like burn after reading without the jokes, which means that you're just looking at... It means more than ever you're asking, what is the point? What is the point here?
Yeah, burn after reading without the jokes does not sound like a very appealing prospect.
No, but hey, five stars. They're your favourite of the films we've covered so far.
I think it is.
Does it go for you? I'm saying this with shock in my voice because I am shocked.
Yeah.
Is your top three of the films that we've covered so far Burn After Reading, Fight Club, The Assassination of Jesse James?
Oh, that's interesting. They seem to be the films I've most praised, right?
You loved Fight Club.
I think that was
Fight Club Dan.
I had a good time.
Is that the three?
Probably. I can't think of any.
In that order?
Because Seven's not there. Yeah. Oh. Assassination of Jesse James is probably a better film than Fight Club.
Meet Joe Bikes, aren't they? Podcast so far, that's it.
Also, a lot of our fans, often an email will be like, and Meet Joe Black is, like, really great. Yeah. I really gotta watch that film again.
Would you, really?
It's worth 4 fucking hours or something. I might.
Please do.
Okay.
It would be really fun.
Write in and tell me I gotta watch Meet Joe Black again, and we can do a...
at thebradpittcast@gmail.com a two-part episode.
Yeah, thebradpittcast@gmail.com. Harass us on Twitter @bradpittcast. Maybe.
Let's do Letterboxd.
Yeah.
I don't have my phone on me, so we have to do it. We have to do it on the.
And I don't have the app because I'm a failure in terms of size.
I mean, do you remember the last film you logged on Letterboxd?
Absolutely not. I want to guess Burn After Reading 4.0. I'm going to say for Burn After Reading.
Did you delete your account?
No.
Did your account get deleted?
Maybe.
No, now I have to see if it's there.
I can download the app again and see if I can... I'm just going to see if I can sign in.
Let's
start looking at...
Either your account got deleted or you got mass followed by your... Ah, here you are. You're following 3 people. You're following me, David Sims of the podcast, Blank Check, Chaos and Collins. Fantastic.
Oh.
Fantastic credit. The last film you... rated was Jonathan Glazer's short film The Fall.
Oh, pretty good.
Which you gave 4 stars to.
Very funny. Maybe I'll get back on the Letterboxd.
October 31st, Halloween, 2 years
ago. I remember. I was here. Wow. All right, yeah, 4.0 is my guess to Burn After Reading. What is it?
3.5.
Oh, that's significantly lower than some films you've watched recently, because I felt like I was lowballing things.
Yeah, I thought it was possible that
that's
you might have
liked it. Very interesting.
So, should we start with a 5-star?
Let's do it.
I'm bringing the laptop.
I'm just saying if I can log in, like, remember the username and password to my letterbox. Nope, okay, I don't know where.
Dan, listen, I don't know what to say to you.
Someone has just quoted, which I think is important to read. We mentioned it. Someone has quoted the final exchange of dialogue in the film, which is J.K. Simmons.
Yeah.
He says, "What do we learn, Palmer? I don't know, sir. I don't fucking know either. I guess we learn not to do it again. Yes, sir. I'm fucked if I know what we did. Yes, sir. Yeah. It's hard to say. Jesus fucking Christ." Great.
It's a good, it's an all-time ending.
Yeah, it really is. All of the 5-star reviews are just saying, like, funny, very funny, hilarious, funny. Osborne Cox, that's funny. That's one whole review.
Osborne Cox, they have great names.
Everyone has great names. Pinchonian names.
Yeah.
Pitt is super freaking hysterical and steals every scene he's in.
That's true. Although, I wouldn't say steals because everyone else is so magnificent. I love Richard Jenkins, by the way.
He's
a human, another humanized actor.
Yeah, he's extraordinary.
In everything he is in.
Yeah, he really fucking is.
His eyes.
Is that what it is? Is that why he's so well used? That he just looks like the nicest human being in the world.
Yeah, there's no situation in which you wouldn't be happy to see Richard Jenkins coming towards you.
Yeah. I mean, he's extraordinary. He's so well used in The Shape of Water, being kind of, like, extremely kind best friend. He's all-time great in Step Brothers. Unbelievable performance.
That's a wonderfully cast film.
Yeah. And he's great in Killing Them Softly.
Okay. I've seen that film, but don't really remember it.
He's just this crumpled middle manager who's, like, so pissed off with Pitt. He, like, stubs out Pitt's cigarette when Pitt goes to the toilet the final scene.
You just gave a look.
I found a good review. There are fewer and fewer good reviews on Letterboxd. It's sad.
Because more people are adopting it?
I don't know what it is. Yeah, there's a lot more have to sift through of people being like, it's funny.
Yeah, sure.
Which, I mean, it is funny.
Yeah, correct.
I'm not making fun of them. This person's top 4 films are interesting. F for Fake. Have you seen that? The Orson Welles
quasi-documentary
about art forgery that is itself kind of a forgery. Yeah, it has an interesting thing to say about kind of art and lies. Okay. Reasonably good. I'm just not huge on Welles.
Yeah.
Apologies to fan of the show and guest, Haley, who is just all in for Welles.
Apologies to Mank.
Apologies to Mank. Sorry, David Fincher. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which I've actually never seen.
I think I have.
Have you?
As a kid, yeah.
The John Ford Western?
I remember a scene from it in which a guy is... I might even talk about this on the podcast before. A guy says, and I always remember this, I must have been like 7 or so. I remember at my grandma's house I was watching it. This guy is like, I prepared a long speech, but today is not a day for speeches. And he tears up his paper and lets it flutter to the ground and there's nothing written on it.
Huh.
I always remember that scene. I think that's from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Incredible. I have a massive John Ford gap in my knowledge. I've seen The Searchers, which I didn't like very much. And I don't think I've seen really much else at all. I really should. It's embarrassing. Bob Fosse's All That Jazz. Have you seen that film?
No.
Have you seen any Fosse?
I don't think so.
Holy moly. All That Jazz is Roy Schneider plays basically a Fosse analogue of this, like, hard-working choreographer who slips in and out of fantasies. He's a drug addict. He's, like, living very hard. And so it alternates between disgust and beauty incredibly well.
Hmm.
You haven't seen Fosse's Lenny Bruce film? You might
That's the one that Bob Dylan wrote the theme song for, right? Mm-hmm. I have not seen that.
It's just called Lenny.
With Dustin Hoffman? That's Lenny Bruce, yeah.
How many films did Fosse make? Because we could put him in 4 or fewer. No, we can't. He made 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Probably 6 or fewer.
And 6 or fewer. We're starting to get a little, stretching that. You can put a lot of people in 6 or fewer. Yeah. And the 4th film is Last Year at Marienbad, the Alan Rene film. I've
heard of that.
It's okay.
Okay.
It's a very early entry in cinematic surrealism. Not that early, 61. But it's... If it catches you at the wrong moment, it's insufferable.
Sure.
And if you're just there for it, it's good. I alternate between the two. Sometimes I find it like, how could I have ever watched this film? And other times I
Funny.
I love it.
The review is, the Coen's most angry flick, oozing with a profound disdain for every person that inhabits this farcical, bleak ensemble piece.
That's interesting.
Most angry.
Miller's Crossing's pretty angry.
Yeah, Miller's... And so, actually, so is A Serious Man, but yeah. Kind of, like, aimlessly angry. Should we do a 3-star, or, like... Or should we just do a couple of lows?
I'm interested in some 1-stars. Because I'm interested... I think... You give this movie 1 star, you have to misunderstand it, which might be snobbish or unfair, but that would be my take. At least worth 3.
Space Tortoise's top 4 films are... I mean, 2 of these films I think are incredible. Superbad. I really like Superbad. Very funny. Extremely funny, beginning to end. Importantly humane when it needs to be. Yeah,
good, well cast.
Doesn't overstay its welcome, doesn't think it's more than it is. Pretty good film. Baby Driver. I fucking hate Edgar Wright's Baby Driver.
That makes sense that you hate that. I thought it was fine. Real slipped in there right before Kevin Spacey got nuked.
Yes.
That would have really fucked that film if it had come out like 3 months later.
Anthony Bourdain, a hero of mine, one of the great...
Yeah, people.
One of the great people. One of the great users of Twitter has an incredible tweet where he just tweeted, "Fuck Baby Driver." Incredible.
I like John Hamm in that film, actually.
I always love John Hamm. Very charismatic
and really... Like, I wanted the film to be about him. I just want a film about him.
Yeah, and he does the turn from charming to sociopathic extremely well. Really with great ease. I'm maybe not joking, and maybe this is divulging something about me that it's on the record. John Hamm has had a hard life. And has struggled with similar things that I've struggled with.
Handsomeness.
Being extraordinarily famous and well paid. No, they're like...
Sorry.
No, it was very funny. I'm very glad you did it. He's been in and out of rehab.
Yeah.
And I stay up late at night hoping that things will turn out for John Hamm. Because maybe... It's talismanic.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe. No, I just think that he's an unbelievably talented performer. By all appearances, an extremely nice man. And since Don Draper, he just hasn't had something worthy of his skills.
I think that might be right.
A Baby Driver, he's extraordinary, but I just want him to be the lead in something.
Wasn't he going to be...
He's going to be the Ben Affleck role in Gone Girl, and Mad Men fucked him. And I think I said on one of our episodes that means a different career for John Hamm, but I don't know if it does. I think the problem is just, despite it all, as Brad Pitt learned, Hollywood doesn't have a space for, like, very handsome men.
Yeah. Whatever. Is this the hill we're dying on? Is there no very space for very handsome white men in Hollywood?
Listen, Dan, please. Particularly in the modern era, though. You have to star in a Marvel movie.
Yeah, are you Chris Hemsworth or bust?
Yeah, and even the Chris Hemsworth projects that aren't Marvel movies don't do particularly well. Not a single person in the world, I have this on authority, watched the Chris Hemsworth film Extraction that was on Netflix. Nobody did. Not a single person.
Like Jason Momoa's weird, like, $1 billion Apple
TV show,
right? Like, again, he's just a, I know he's not Marvel, but like, just you comic books or
Or nothing.
Yeah,
nothing. So what's John Hamm gonna fucking do? He's just gonna be in comedies, I think. It's like, it's John Hamm. This person's third film, The Empire Strikes Back.
Good film.
Must be one of the most common films we find in top 4s.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Along with Apocalypse Now. Mm. Interesting that everyone likes Empire the best. Because it's darkest, bleak.
Right. I think that people are like, it's the most serious.
Sure. 4.4 is the average rating of Empire Strikes
Back. That is amazing.
This person's fourth favourite film, directed by an Australian and therefore friend of the podcast. Mm-hmm. 3-star film, apparently, is what I gave it. Peter Weir's The Truman Show.
I taught that film a couple years ago. A lot of fun to teach. Pretty good.
Love it.
3 stars.
3 stars.
Teaching it turned me around on it a bit, actually.
Hmm.
It's doing some stuff. It's pretty good.
It's just... It's a little bit in a very complicated way, I guess. The last line is pretty good when they're like, let's see what else is on. That's funny.
Yeah.
This half a star review just says, don't tell me what to fucking do.
All right. As in, like, the title is an imperative, burn after reading?
I guess so. I'm just going to read you this review. This made no sense. Maybe needs a rewatch. My brain was fried watching the plot unfold. Plus, the plot of the movie is kind of stupid. Fuck this movie and fuck someone's username, Discord username. So, I don't know what the hell that's
about. They must have recommended it, I guess.
This is horrible. The only good thing about it is Brad Pitt.
We got to end on a 5-star.
I don't care if the Coen brothers did this. It's so dumb. This was my quickest ever DNF. Did not finish.
That's crazy.
I think I got like 10 minutes in. 10 minutes!
The first 10 minutes are great.
Okay, I'll just read you this half a star review and then we'll end on a 5-star. This person's top 4 films. Children of Men. I love that film. There is a shootout sequence in the Black Panther's headquarters that happens in Judas and the Black Messiah. That made me think a lot of the kind of climactic scene in Children of Men where there's this shootout that gets resolved by the baby kind of being presented. And it has a lot of kind of Steadicam one-take stuff in Judas and the Black Messiah, which Cuaron does very smart in Children of Men. I really like Children of Men.
It's a very good film.
Kiss Me Deadly, a noir film, pretty good.
Okay.
Paris, Texas, have you seen it?
No, I should.
I think you'd quite like it. Sad, mournful, elegiac, based on a Sam Shepard script.
Bendis.
Yeah. Yeah. Who I don't love.
Okay.
His career is pretty spotty, but that one's good.
Nice.
Watched it with my dad when I was like 15.
I can imagine watching that with my dad.
And this person's fourth favourite film is on the record one of my favourite films of all time.
The Exorcist?
No. Guess again.
Texas Chainsaw.
Guess again. I made you watch it. You watched it with me. Might have been the first film we watched together. Dragged to
Hell? No.
Older. Much older.
Oh, it's the first film shot in New York, right?
Sweet Smell of Success.
I couldn't remember the name. That is a great film.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that is a masterpiece.
It's talking about lines that just, like, rattle around your head for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
There's a line in that film, where Burt Lancaster's character, a towering performance by Burt Lancaster, says, "The cat's in the bag and the bag's in the river." And it's just like, that's it.
Yeah, that's fucking what we watch cinema for.
Fucking poetry. So the person with those top 4 films, their review is, Burn After Reading is a hateful film.
Oh,
a bunch of actors give terrible performances of this story about two morons who get in over their heads. Every actor in this ratchets his/her performance to the level of the grotesque, and they're all about equally unwatchable. John Malkovich is one note, while George Clooney and Frances McDormand's mug and grimace their way embarrassingly through the plot. Brad Pitt, who I guess is supposed to be our comic relief, it's everyone's comic relief.
Yeah, it's a comedy.
Is painfully unfunny. The story itself isn't bad, but instead of the clever dialogue, you can usually rely on the Coens to deliver. The brothers fall back instead of repeated uses of the F word and some dildo humor.
Okay, well, we see this person's problem. The
more dildo humor,
but please. Also they're like very funny that they just don't realize it's because to say the story's not bad. It's like, what the fuck is the story? There's no story. Yeah. Basically, the story's incoherent. That's the point.
Yeah, how could
it's
you?
Not about, it's about the performances. Yeah. It's specifically a showcase.
How could you be like actors? The performances?
Yeah,
you know,
I genuinely don't. I don't know like the performances,
but I love the plot. All right, let's end on a 5-star. One of the funniest and most creative movies ever made. This person speaks like me.
Very sweet.
I mean, really, why the fuck would they go to the Russians? Why the fuck?
Pretty good.
I'm going to find a proper one to end on. Just everyone's just being, like, funny. Himbo Brad Pitt is something that can be so personal.
I guess. What does that mean?
You think that's a Schwinn? Everyone's quoting, yeah. You think that's a Schwinn.
That's a good line.
I can safely say this is one of the funniest movies ever made. Do you think that's true?
I mean, what about, like, Duck Soup or something? I don't know.
Duck Soup?
My brothers are very funny.
Are you, how old are you? Are you 900 years old? I don't know about this burn after reading. I'm going to watch some fucking Groucho Marx.
His Girl Friday? I don't know.
His Girl Friday's pretty funny.
What is The Graduate. This is Spinal Tap, I think, actually. I would put this as Spinal Tap, because every single line is hilarious in Spinal Tap, especially in the first half. And the second half is like every second line. That is, I saw that in a cinema with Dad, and we were just, I almost felt self-conscious about the fact that we were constantly laughing, just not stopping laughing.
Yeah.
What a perfect film.
I haven't seen it in ages.
That's so good.
Step Brothers is,
for Step Brothers is very funny. Like, Adam Scott in that film.
Unbelievable. Oh. The cutaway gag where he's like, look at my abs, and it's clearly someone else's abs, is so funny.
Another handsome man who hasn't really had his day.
Yeah. But a bit more one note than Ham. Sure. Ham has a sadness. What are you laughing about?
That's just a good name for something.
Ham has a sadness. Yeah.
Write a poem about it with that title.
I will. Oh. Shit. This person has another of my all-time favorite movies in their top four. Alan Pakula's The Parallax View with Warren Beatty. I fucking love The Parallax View. Paul Schrader's Blue Collar. I love that film. Richard Pryor and Keitel. Haven't seen it in a while. Fargo.
Great.
And Stalag 17, which is a Billy Wilder film. Director of
The Apartment.
Many, many masterpieces. Yeah. The Apartment, Sunset Boulevard, etc. Yeah. I've never seen it. William Holden. It's meant to be pretty good. Most of these people give it four or five stars. This review. We're at the tail end of the Bush era. Almost 7 years of the Patriot Act.
Mm.
Everyone is being watched. And everyone is aware of being watched. It's this hyper-awareness that the Coens burrow into in such a black, sardonic way. What is it we have learned here? J.K. Simmons asked this towards the end. No one knows. We just watchers who can't interpret what we see. It's an entanglement of wires and obsolete workout equipment. Just what are we looking at here? The things we've made and the games that we play, all the rules have been forgotten. We're just left with our surface attentions and our vague paranoias propped up by every spy movie we've ever seen. It's not the Reagan-era Clancy hero Jack Ryan we see here. No, it's the bumbling, bushy with a capital B, broadness of mid-level ineffectiveness, stretching out into the long lens of a surveillance satellite in space. We're all being watched, but just what are they looking at?
Pretty good.
Thanks. Nice,
thank you.
John Mayhall.
Excellent.
I don't know the film we're going to do next, but part of my brain tells me it's Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, maybe it is. That's fine. I am worried. I'm just not looking forward to the next venture.
Oh, Daniel.
So long.
Listen.
Just serialize it.
Listen. I'm not very good at being angry, and I've learned that the way I try and sound angry is by saying, listen.
It's like, yeah, that's right. It's like the Jerry Seinfeld, like.
Yeah, trying to be angry.
Yeah.
I think maybe my life would be better if I was angrier. Fucking, it's better than fucking being sad all the time. I tell you that.
It depends. Anger tends to have objects. Be honest.
Sadness is just you fucking hate yourself all the time, Dan.
That's true. I'm not
what the hell? Sadness. I want to be angry about someone else for fucking once. Christ Almighty! Not my own brain.
Sure.
Do you know what the next film is?
Is it Inglourious Basterds? It's not Benjamin Button, is it?
Okay. It's Benjamin Button.
All right.
So this
see
is
you
the,
in 6 months.
This is the last episode of Brad Pitt, guys. Dan, do you know how many minutes it is?
500. It's already at the cinema. I remember being like, how is this thing not over?
166.
Oh, is that? Okay, that's not that bad.
It's under 3 hours.
That's surprising. I genuinely thought it was.
Is it shorter than Meet Joe Black? Time to find out.
Yeah, I think it is. We did 2 episodes about Meet Joe Black.
We should do 6 episodes. Benjamin Button is a pretty good movie.
Okay, maybe I'll enjoy it. I mean, my expectations are so low. I did see it.
I don't know why you wouldn't like it. It's like a very Dan, like,
I just remember being very bored.
So, you know, kind of beautiful, lush romance.
I saw him sing it with someone. I should try and find out who that was.
Invite him on the podcast.
Sure.
Meet Joe Black is 181 minutes long.
Yeah.
And Curious Case of Benjamin Button is 166. Benjamin, yeah. Benjamin Button.
Which is where? Which the Assassination Gesture? Yeah, I guess I was just trying to work out which title was longer, but definitely Assassination Gesture. Definitely Assassination.
I'm trying to find you something from the Wikipedia page that will make you excited.
Yeah, about what does Richard Brody think of Benjamin Button? Let's get him on the record. What did Anthony Lane review?
Maybe Brody wasn't working at the New Yorker then?
I think he might have just started. He would have been working somewhere, like with that beard.
Here you go.
Oh, he has?
You ready?
Yeah.
The director, David Fincher, and the writers, Eric Roth, one of the writers of Forrest Gump, and Robert Swycord, rework F. Scott Fitzgerald's gentle fantasy about a man who is born old and ages in reverse into a sumptuous and stirring romantic drama.
Okay.
With the framework of a long-hidden diary and a mysterious tale of concealed paternity, they turn Benjamin's recollections into flashbacks that begin with his birth on November 11,
1918. Oh, boy.
Is this having the opposite effect?
Yeah, I'm having flashbacks.
Bits, face, and head, made up to appear aged, are digitally grafted onto a child's body. The result is an exquisite hyperrealism that floats through history with the fragile bliss of dreams.
Okay.
In his youth, Benjamin meets a girl named Daisy, who, as an adult, played by Cate Blanchett, is the love of his life. She grows older as he becomes ever younger. His sense of being out of sync with his time yields an intensified sense of mortality. His keen, quiet serenity is perched on the edge of tears. That Richard Brody can write a sentence.
He can write a sentence, actually.
The movie's framing story, set in a New Orleans hospital during Hurricane Katrina, is a grave reminder of tragic impermanence.
All right. Look, if Richard likes it, I'll give it a shot. Well, I look forward to it.
No, you don't!
That is a lie.
What can we do to make you watch that film in one sitting?
Oh, boy. Can we start a GoFundMe for snacks or something?
What would it require?
It's a very good question.
Average rating for Benjamin Button is 3.6.
Okay, so it's 0.1 better than Burn After Reading.
There's nothing that I could offer you that would make you say, what can I do?
What can you, Joseph, do for me?
I tell you what,
mm-hmm.
If you do Curious Case of Benjamin Button in one sitting, then something, something, song to song.
Okay.
Like, I'll watch song to song in one sitting.
And then we talk about it on the podcast.
A
Malick cast. that's too much. I'm not even sure how much I like Terrence Malick. I've only seen two of his films that I loved, but...
Is that not enough?
That's pretty good. That's pretty encouraging. Let's put that on the record tentatively, but something of that kind.
I just don't know what else I can offer.
I know, I'm not, and I don't want to drag you through that.
Has your partner seen Curious Case of Benjamin
Button? I don't know. I'll ask her.
Surely we can imagine the world where you order yourself some, like, delicious food.
Yeah, sit down.
You, like, spend a little money on, like, a bottle of wine that is more expensive than you would usually buy.
Yeah.
You turn off the lights, you light some candles, you
press play. With Cate Blanchett and Brad Pitt.
You start at 6 p.m. on the dot, so you're done by 8:35.
With credits, yeah.
You can have, like, a nice little dessert.
Sure.
Maybe a little espresso.
Yeah.
Sit in bed, read the paper, go to sleep. Surely.
It's within the realm of possibility.
What does that mean?
I can try it. I'll try. I will make plans.
You have to front load the evening with plans.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
So you have to have dinner. There's no way. If you press
play.
If you press play on The Curious Case of Benjamin Button at, like, 11 a.m. on a Saturday, there's no way.
Yeah, of course.
There's no way.
I think I watched Major Black in, like, 8 parts.
But yeah.
I think I watched Ben After Reading in 2.
Yeah, yeah. Have you watched a single movie for this podcast beginning to end?
Definitely, but not in a little while.
Since you watched them with me?
I think I have, but not in a little while.
What?
Watched the Brad Pitt Mexico one in one go.
Oh, fucking hell, really? Yeah. I did not
watch
that one.
I think I watched the Mexican in one go.
Oh, well, then I don't.
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
Then you're an alien. Then you're unaccountable to me.
Do it.
Okay.
Email.
Oh, yeah.
Email yeah, them.
Please encourage us.
Because Dan has the Pitcast email get forward to his regular
we're
email.
We're getting some spam. I don't know who signed us up for.
We're getting so that much spam. That seems to have
reduced. But yeah, thebradpitcast@gmail.com. Twitter @bradpitcast. Rate and review us, please.
Tell fucking Dan to watch Curious Case of Ben Benjamin Button in one go.
There are worse torches.
Maybe I'll book a cinema.
They're pretty cheap at the moment.
Yeah, and also, you know, I'm having a hard time in my life and I could weaponize that. I could be like, Dan,
this is what I need.
Really, the only thing that will keep me together is if you come out with me tonight. You'd and be like, watch. Of course.
Yeah.
And then we rock up at the cinema.
Spring. I've got a +1 to the screening of Benjamin Button.
And listen, no I don't know what come. I'm doing with myself. I gotta... See you next time.
We love you.
We love ya.
See you next time. See you for Benjamin Button. You watch it too. You all watch it in one sitting. See how you like it, and then we'll talk about it.
A great film.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.